I spent the last while at my mom and dad's house in South Texas. My dad died a few years ago. And so I was thinking about him while I was there and looking at some old pictures. And I found a picture of my grandpa, who I never met. He died when my dad was 19. And I was thinking back to the last substantive conversation that I had with my dad, which was via email. He was really sick and in and out of the hospital. And I just asked him, like, Dad, like, what do you really believe? Just, I'm curious. And he sat with it and he wrote me this long email. And it was actually about his dad. And it turns out that my grandfather was a socialist. His name was Alois Redding Sharon. And his father and mother, my great-grandparents, came from Switzerland. And they homesteaded on Shell Creek in north central Wyoming. And sometimes I think they just kept, you know, they got off the boat and they kept coming west until they saw mountains like they recognized from Switzerland. And it's one of those like iconic stories. Like they literally had a covered wagon and they came out and they, you know, cut down trees and built a, I don't think they ever had a sod hut because there wasn't any sod. This is like the desert west, but they built a log cabin. And so I've been thinking about that fact that he was a socialist, and especially in this recent climate with all the hyperbole about socialism as like completely un-American. And I can only say, like, my dad's family was very patriotic to a fault. Like my grandpa's brother, my great uncle, was named Benjamin Franklin Sharon, for heaven's sakes. Like how can you, how can you, you gotta love that. And so since I found out my dad was a socialist, I've been like trying to find out more, reading up on it. And it's a longstanding and important political tradition in America. And during my grandpa's life, he supported Eugene Debs, who was a like really important union organizer. He led strikes and got thrown in jail for trying to organize rail workers. And he was also a five-time candidate for president of the United States starting in 1900. And like he did pretty well. He didn't like, you know, ever come close to winning, but he was a legit like third party candidate at the time. And more importantly, maybe he changed the circumstances of the working class, of the poor in this country. And he also happened to inspire a young man to a career in politics, whose name is Bernie Sanders. Bernie's always had a picture of Eugene Debs in his office and does now in the Senate office. And as I've been thinking about like this moment and the tensions around like socialism and what we call each other, what names we call each other, and what people mean when they say America's core value is freedom or liberty, and somehow socialism doesn't recognize that. I've been trying to sort out for myself, like, what do people mean in this country? And what does our country mean when it flies the flag of liberty up the flagpole? And as a part of my training, I, you know, studied the Enlightenment philosophers, and I know there's this twofold understanding of freedom that's embedded in our political life, positive and negative liberty. And I think it's important. I think it's important to understand sort of the fruitfulness of that and how it's getting twisted right now. So let me just unpack it for a second so that I can then refer to it and we have a sense of how that plays out. Negative liberty is like something that gives an opportunity that wasn't there. So like the 13th Amendment to the Constitution banning slavery, or the 19th Amendment to the Constitution banning discrimination and voting on the basis of sex. Those give African Americans and women, in theory, a wider share and the opportunity to exercise their full humanity. So that's that's one side of it, negative liberty. But positive liberty is like the First Amendment that gives us the right to have freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of assembly. Like it's an exercise. We get to exercise these rights as a part of our positive liberty. And the Enlightenment philosophers who influenced the founding fathers, especially Thomas Jefferson and his writing of the Declaration of Independence, had this idea that government should be sworn by the people. And so you needed freedom from the tyranny of a monarch or from a despot. And you needed freedom to exercise one's rights toward the common good. Like a popular democracy means that people act together for the common good of the country. And those are the ideas embedded in the Constitution and its many amendments. Now, obviously, I know there are huge problems with the Enlightenment and its embodiment in American political and social institutions. Like those same philosophers literally helped invent the modern theory of racial hierarchy that justified European imperialism and all of its horrific outcomes and up to the legacy that we live with today. So that's also true. And I'm holding that complexity. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Hannah Johnston in her sermon pointed out that the term itself, enlightenment, bears some of that problematic character. Sort of it's a self-designation of themselves as superior. So in this current context that we're in with pandemic and protest, socialism or like the radical left are being made out to be un-American. And I think our basic understandings of freedom rooted in our history as a country are being twisted for political purposes, really beyond recognition. Like under the guise of protest over government tyranny and suppression of their supposed freedom, last week a older white couple went to a Walmart here in Minnesota wearing Nazi masks. And when they were confronted, they said, the woman said, "I'm trying to tell you what's going to happen in America. We're living under a socialist state. If you vote for Biden, you're going to be living in Nazi Germany." So they wore the masks, but the point they were trying to make was like, you all should know that we're living in a socialist country. Well, they were called to account by a Lutheran intern at a Lutheran parish in Minnesota. Her name's Rafaela Mueller from Healing Waters Lutheran Parish in Minnesota. And she grew up in Germany, actually, and she came as an adult to go to seminary in the U.S. and then work towards ordination in the Lutheran Church. And she knows the story of what happened in Germany. She grew up in Berlin and listening to her grandma tell her stories. And she went up to these people and said, "Please take off the mask. It's offensive and hateful to wear them." And the store manager offered the couple generic masks that they had available for any customers who were in store. And the couple refused. And they got banned from Walmart stores for a year. They didn't get arrested. Their names weren't released. So their privacy was protected. Their argument for what they were doing, to my mind, wasn't any different than all the armed white anti-quarantine, quote, liberate the states protesters that went to state capitals earlier this spring. In effect, they want freedom from belonging to the well-being of others. And they want freedom to do whatever the hell they want, whenever they want to, actually endangering the common good rather than building it up. Like that feels to me like flipping the understanding of freedom that actually makes sense of the best ideals of this country. So that's worrisome to me, not just because there are a couple of instances of that happening, because it's a whole sort of segment of American society. It's Fox News America. It's Donald Trump's America. He gave this ominous speech at Mount Rushmore on the 4th of July, standing under our four presidents immortalized there. And described America as under attack from angry mobs trying to tear down statues of our founders and deface our most sacred memorials and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities. He said these radical leftists claim that their goal is social justice, but in fact, they don't want a better America. They want the end of America. And he used that then to justify sending these federal agents into cities like Portland. He said he was going to do it in the speech on July 4th. And he did it. Sorry, you can hear Walt eating my shoe. He thinks it's an animal and he's trying to kill it. I assure you, my shoe is already dead. So Trump did send in the federal agents. And in Portland, I like to think of it this way. We the people stood up with walls of Black Matters protesters, with walls of moms, with walls of veterans, with walls of ordinary citizens, saying the government has to be held accountable. Police must be accountable. They can't shoot us and gas us for existing, for buying Skittles, for jogging, for driving, for sleeping, for shopping, for just being at home. They can't shoot us and gas us for exercising our right to seek the common good or to seek redress of grievances from the government, as it says in the First Amendment. I was so moved by the way Representative John Lewis depicted this in the op-ed that was published on the day of his funeral. He wrote it a few weeks before he died. And he said, when you see something that's not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state, it's an act. And each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and world society at peace with itself. Ordinary people, he said, with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting into what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. I love that. That's exact opposite of what President Trump was depicting in his speech on the 4th of July. I like the good trouble part, but I especially like the democracy as an act part. We have to act to make democracy. And he made sure that we heard him say, it's not just you or I, but we together who make the beloved community. I think that about being Christian. Martin Luther spoke of becoming Christian rather than being Christian. His understanding of how often we fall short and how much we depend on God's grace led him to speak of our lives like dough, and God's grace like yeast that works to leaven us through our whole lives. It's like we're the slowest raising dough ever. We get up every day, trusting in God's grace and mercy, seek to be the body of Christ in the world together, with and for each other, and with and for the world. That's actually the miracle here in this passage in Matthew that's sometimes called the feeding of the 5,000. I wanted to call it that because I want to stop calling it that, because clearly if you read the last sentence, there was many more than 5,000, right? 5,000 men besides women and children. So let's call it the feeding of the 15,000. Who knows how many were there? You can call it the feeding of the multitude. But the story itself is too often a story purported to be one of those miracles that shows Jesus to truly be God because he can do magic tricks, making what was enough food for a handful of people into enough food to feed thousands. Well, I think it is a miracle, this story, but a different sort of miracle. And I learned this way of thinking about it from my congregation's visit to Nicaragua when I was in seminary. We had a sister congregation in Nicaragua, and so we went to visit, and I was at this base Christian community, one of the small Catholic communities inspired by liberation theology, and there was this woman there, a catechist, a popular educator, and she had us sit down in a circle outside of her house, and she used this story as a story to sort of teach us about communal empowerment. And she said, in this story, the people are depicted as poor and hungry, as desperate. They have little. They're oppressed by a violent and powerful force in their nation. She said, they're just like we are. And they flocked to Jesus because they heard he was changing things. And perhaps God had sent him to free us from bondage, from all that we're suffering. And after a long day of teaching, his disciples want to send the people away to go and fend for themselves for their dinner. But Jesus knows the power of organizing, of collective power, and he organizes them to sit down. It's interesting in the Gospel of Mark and of Luke, which also have this story, Jesus has them sit down in groups of about 50. So it's even a more explicit acknowledgement of Jesus organizing people as they sat down. And he proceeds to take what little he has, the few loaves and fishes the disciples thought was not enough. And in Eucharistic fashion, he looks up to heaven and he gives thanks and breaks them and gives them to the disciples to share with the people. Freed from a scarcity mentality, from a deficit frame of not enough, Jesus organizes the people to see the abundance they already have, and people share in their groups, finding they not only have enough, but they have more than enough. They have an abundance. So I came back from that trip, and I was super excited about it, and I decided to teach that in our Bible study at my church in a suburban Bay Area congregation. And this retired investment broker was sitting there listening to me, and he sat back, and at the end of the lesson, he said, "Young man, that's not Christianity, that's socialism." And after being shocked for a minute, I said, "Jim, I don't know if it's socialism or not, but that's what we do at the Eucharist every week. All are fed and all have enough." So that's in a sense the lesson I think my grandfather learned struggling to pull a living out of the dry, rocky land of Wyoming. Like, they literally needed their neighbors to survive. Alone, they wouldn't have had enough. But together, they made a life that was enough for all of them. And I think that's us as a community. When we say, "This is my body," we say we're giving ourselves to each other. Freedom from isolation and scarcity, freedom to claim our dignity as made in the image and likeness of God, all of us, promised abundant life. So it forces us, in a sense, to move beyond fear and violence that drives us apart and claim the wisdom that Jesus offers, saying, "No, we belong to each other. We in belonging to each other, and especially in centering and listening to the poor and the suffering in our midst, we can discover the abundance that's promised is already present in our midst, with and for us."